This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men. Real clothing for real people. Proud to sponsor the important voice of KABU, Gazelle is located at Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-288-3422.
And this KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizzicato pizza, and all-new seating. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
Good morning. My name is Ed Goldberg. I'm here with my friend and colleague,
Dawn Taylor.
DK Holm is taking the month of February off because he's working on a book. I took the month of January off because I was working on a book, which, thank heaven, I have finished. At least I've got, you know, the draft ready to go to the editor.
So what you're saying is I have to start writing a book.
No pressure. No pressure.
It's my turn.
Well, the thing is, though, that I haven't seen too many films, and for one reason or another, you haven't either. So.
Yeah. I've been working on my book.
We do have a fairly full show, though, so that's good. Before we get started, I'd like to remind people that on the 14th of February, besides being Valentine's Day, my friend Bruce Silverman, who is a film buff and goes to all of the screenings at the Northwest Film Center for the film festival, is going to have some of his friends come along. I want to say 9:30, I think that's right, on the 14th, and discuss the films of the film festival. And these are not, you know, movie critics. These are like real people as opposed to us, for example.
Yeah, we're not real people.
Yeah. So, again, that's the 14th Tuesday at 9:30, Bruce Silverman and friends discussing the PIFF films.
And they did this last year, and it was a lot of fun.
Yes. And it's nice to know that there are people out there who love films as much as we do and don't feel the compulsion to talk about it.
and they love films, and they're a lot nicer about them than we are.
I wonder what that means. Okay, just to remind everybody one more thing before we get rolling on the movies, we do have a email address for Movie Talk, KABU Movie Talk, all one word as usual, KBOO Movie Talk at yahoo.com. Tell us about Mrs. Henderson.
Mrs. Henderson Presents is a film from Stephen Frears, starring Judy Dench as a woman who actually did exist in the 1930s. She had been the wife of a diplomat, and when he died, she returned from India and was sort of at loose end. So she bought the Windmill Theater in London's West End, which was on its last legs and was dying. And she decided she wanted to put on 24-hour, all-the-time, never-closing vaudeville-style revues. She hired a manager, who's played by Bob Hoskins, and even though they were open all of the time, everybody else started opening all of the time, too, to sort of compete, and she wanted to make some money, so she decided what they needed was nudity, and put partially clad showgirls on the stage. And the film is basically just about that. It's she is sort of this eccentric, lovable little woman. Is one of those tour de force kind of roles that Judy Dench excels at. Bob Hoskins is Bob Hoskins with sort of this posh accent, and he is sort of outrageous.
Bob Hoskins with a posh accent?
Yes, and it's not believable for a moment. It's a terrible, terrible accent.
He's a Cockney, he is.
I know, and he tries to put on this upper crust accent. It just doesn't work. Someone who does do an excellent upper crust accent, though, is Christopher Guest, who plays Lord Cromer, the Lord Chamberlain of England at the time, and he is concerned about the nudity and talks to Mrs. Henderson about it a lot, and basically agrees that she can put on her shows if, when the women are on stage, they don't move, that because that would be too lascivious. So she basically invents sort of the tableau where these women would where they would put on these sort of reenactments of classic literature and of mythology with
only half naked
with these showgirls partially draped so that their breasts are showing. And it's a lovely, I saw it months ago, they held the the release of this for ages. I think because they wanted to push Judi Dench for an Oscar, so they wanted to bring it out closer to Oscar time. And it's directed by Stephen Frears, who is one of my favorite directors. I love Judi Dench, love Christopher Guest, love Bob Hoskins. So maybe my expectations were a little high when I went to see this, but it's nice. It's a nice, fluffy little movie that doesn't really do a whole lot. It has a slightly too cheery sort of perspective on London during the Blitzkrieg. They throw in a little bit of newsreel footage to kind of let you know, oh yeah, things were bad. And then towards the end of the film, there's this out of nowhere expository monologue by Ms. Dench explaining her motivation for doing all of this, which is very maudlin and very scenery chewing and just kind of like, what? So I have to say, it's not a great movie. It's a very nice little movie. If you like little British movies and you like Judi Dench, honestly, all of this was done a little bit better in Topsy Turvy.
Sounds like a rental.
It would be a very nice rental. Very good rental. Have a beverage, sit on your couch, watch this movie. I give it a B-. It's not a bad movie by any means, but it's certainly nothing that you should go out of your way to see if you don't have, like, intense interest.
I find it very amusing that Christopher Guest has a better English accent than Bob Hoskins.
He's actually a lord. He comes from a long line of British lords, and he himself is actually a lord. He's a member of the House of Commons.
Well, You could knock me over with a feather.
He does a wonderful British accent.
Lord Christopher, eh? Okay. Okay, so that was Mrs. Henderson Presents. And
yes,
if you like whimsy with naked girls, it's your flick.
There you
right?
go.
Yeah, okay. Boy, going from one extreme to the other, those of us of a certain age will remember Emmett Till, or at least hearing about Emmett Till. Bob Dylan, one of his early protest songs was called The Death of Emmett Till. It was a young man. Well, this is a film, a documentary film, the title of which is The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till, directed by Keith A. Beauchamp, pronounced Beecham in England. But he's a 14-year-old boy from Chicago whose grandfather lived in Mississippi. And he and two of his cousins went down to Mississippi for summer vacation. Why in the world anybody would go to Mississippi for summer vacation, especially a young black man in the 50s, is completely amazing to me. But they did. I guess they wanted to get him out in the country.
It's like being gay and going to Salt Lake City.
Something like that. You know, worse even. Worse.
Yes.
Because it turns out that in Mississippi in those days, being black was a crime. And what this poor kid did was, he was mischievous. He was a cut up and a wise guy. He said something to a white woman. First of all, he touched her hand, which was not a good thing. But he didn't know you weren't supposed to do that. But then he wolf whistled at her. You know, the old, that kind of thing. That was his death sentence, because he was taken out of his grandfather's house that night, brutally beaten and tortured, and then tied to a fan from a cotton gin and thrown into the lake, whatever it was down there, and naturally died. But the beating he received before that was totally brutal. Well, everybody knew who the real killers were, and they went on trial, and they were, of course, acquitted, because you did not convict a white man of killing a black man in Mississippi in the 1950s. Emmett's mother, Mamie, back in Chicago, when you talk about Rosa Parks, you talk about all the great heroes of the Civil Rights Movement, you never hear much about Mamie Till. But in her own way, she was as important as Rosa Parks. Not as visible, not as public, and it was a much more personal thing. She refused to take what happened to her son lying down. She went down to Mississippi. She sat in through the trial. She gave press conferences every day when she walked out of the trial. These guys were going to get exonerated. Everybody knew it. When the body was shipped back to Chicago, and she had to have it shipped back to Chicago, they were going to bury it in a potter's field in Mississippi. She had an open casket at Emmett's funeral, and the brutality visited on this kid was all over him. The mortician said, "Can't we fix his face up?" She says, "No, I want people to see what they did to him." This woman was heroic and brave, and because of her, a lot of changes have come down over the years because of some of the things she set in motion. People who saw this, white people in power who saw that Emmett Till, said this can't go on much longer. It's incredible. It's hair-raising. This movie must be seen. certainly for young people who don't know what it was like in this country in the 50s and in Mississippi, which was almost, it was South Africa. It was worse than South Africa. I give the documentary an A. It's the Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till. Go see it. Now, Final Destination 3. We're going,
We're
being whipsawed. I know. I'm sorry. I know. It's like following a leper on Survivor.
Final Destination 3 is the third installment, naturally enough, in the Final Destination series by James Wong and Glenn Morgan, who are alumnus, I can never remember which is which.
Alumni is plural.
Thank you. of the X-Files, and they've made a couple of decent little movies. The one they did, Crispin Glover's Marvelous Willard, a couple of years ago, which was delightful. But James Wong directed the first one, and he's back to direct the third one. And if you've seen the first two, you basically know the premise. A whole bunch of people, of kids, teenagers, are supposed to die, you know, by some accident, some big horrible group accident. Several of them cheat death by the first installment, they get off the airplane that crashes. In the second one, they end up not dying in the big multiple car collision that happens, which is very gory. And in this one, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who was very good in Sky High last year, has like a vision of this roller coaster crashing at the high school grad night and shrieks until they let a bunch of them off, and seven of them get off, and then the roller coaster does indeed crash, and then of course death must have its will, because that's basically the premise of this. If you're supposed to die, if it's your time, it's your time. And once you die, if you cheat death, it's going to come after you anyway. So that said, she does a decent job of what she's supposed to do, which is basically run and try to alert each of her friends that they're about to die and get there just in time to see them die in some wackily creative way by killer tanning bed or hydraulic nail gun or something.
I thought you said killer tanning bed.
I did say killer tanning bed. I don't think I'm giving away anything too much, because I think it's in the commercials, but the two very vain, ultra-hot girls who tan a lot, they're the first ones to go, and they die in the tanning beds, topless. So you get your booby rash.
Mrs. Henderson would approve.
Yes, Mrs. Henderson would approve very much, but they do move because, you know, they're trying to get out. It's kind of an interesting thing, because this is becoming a franchise now. And while it's not a terrible movie, it's a film that, once again, has the same plot as the first two. So much like, say, the Friday the 13th franchise, the only reason that anyone will go to this movie at this point is simply to watch the different ways that they come up with to kill people. Which is not a bad reason to see a movie. I mean, it's, again, Wong and Morgan are clever writers. Wong is a decent director. The film is not unentertaining. It's just, you know, don't expect to be surprised by anything. It's again, it's a movie that would be a much better rental, I think, than spending full price to go see it in a theater. But if you liked the first two, you might like this. My only real comment is that the first one, the accident was this huge, horrific plane crash. The second one was this brilliantly realized multiple car collision with a logging truck, which is a big fear of us in the Pacific Northwest, being on a highway with a logging truck crushing us. But really, this one, it's a roller coaster at grad night. So I was with the law of diminishing sequels. Final Destination 4, I think, the filmmakers can use this if they want. I'll give this to them for free. I'm seeing a golf cart collision at an assisted living facility. Just keep working it down the line of excitement until they get to that. I give Final Destination 3 a B. Not a terrible movie. You know, if you like the first two, go ahead.
Yeah, I saw every Friday the 13th movie but the last one. By that time, I had kind of thought they ran out the string. And all I went for to see is the creative new ways that they could kill nubile teenagers.
This is essentially the premise of the Final Destination franchise as well.
Okay, well, you get to tell us about Firewall, too, which is Harrison Ford's new, shall I say, vehicle?
Oh, his new vehicle, Firewall, which for some reason, I kept calling it Freefall. I kept referring it, and then I realized, I think that it was sort of a subconscious thing that I was doing, thinking about Harrison's career. Firewall, he plays Jack Stanfield, and I looked on IMDb because I really, honest to God, I believe this had to be like the sixth or seventh time he played a character named Jack. But in reality, it's only like the fourth. But he plays Jack Stanfield, who is a security specialist who works for a bank, and his family is kidnapped by a bad guy played by Paul Bettany, who is going to force him to hack into, you know, use his mad computer skills to transfer a whole bunch of money to a Cayman Islands account. And that's the entire plot. It's so much every movie like this you have ever seen, only worse.
A paint-by-numbers movie?
Yes. And it's especially bad because this is a film that looks like it was rewritten as they went along. We have the wife, who's played by Virginia Madsen, who is 40-ish, married to Harrison Ford, who is 60-something. They have a 14-year-old daughter and a 9-year-old son. At the beginning of the film, the 14-year-old daughter keeps calling him by his first name, Jack, leading you to believe that perhaps he is the stepfather. But yet, nothing ever comes of this, and you never find out why she did that. It seemed like it was
hormones.
For a week. Maybe that's it. He works with Robert Forster, who is like his best pal and a security expert guy, who it looks like for a while Robert Forster is going to have something to do with the plot, and he doesn't. Robert Patrick is the head of security for the other bank that is merging with his bank, and they don't like each other. They butt heads. But finally, Robert Patrick says to him at one point, "Hey, Jack, if you ever need anything from me, give me a call. I'm here." So you go, okay.
Grudging respect. Eh?
At the end of the, somewhere towards the end of the film, he's going to need help, and he's going to ask Robert Patrick, right? No. Nothing. Robert Patrick just completely disappears and is gone, and nothing happens. This is a terrible movie. This is a terrible, terrible movie that most of the action involves Harrison Ford tapping away at a keyboard, looking at a computer monitor, while the music plays and tries to whip up some excitement. Paul Bettany is one of the worst bad guys, and I love Paul Bettany. He's a marvelous actor. But his character in this film is one of the worst bad guys I've ever seen. He's got a family. He keeps trying to threaten Harrison Ford with the family. Okay, I'm going to break your kid's knee. And Harrison Ford says, "Please don't." He's like, "Well, okay." And he doesn't. The kid, however, does have a peanut allergy. So later in the film, Paul Bettany gives him a cookie.
Oh, jeez.
That's how evil he is. Ooh. He gives him a cookie. This movie is just abominable. This is the kind of film that people in the theater were laughing out loud at it while just, it's preposterous. It's preposterous from a computer standpoint, with Harrison Ford whipping out a laptop and tossing it on the hood of a car in the middle of nowhere and just immediately logging onto the internet, because apparently in the woods outside of Seattle, Wi-Fi is everywhere.
This is possible.
It's just awful. Awful, awful, awful. Harrison Ford, I love Harrison Ford. I have always loved Harrison Ford, but he is just too old to be a two-fisted action hero. He beats people up. He runs and runs and runs. He climbs things. He smacks people around. And you're just going, dude, you're a senior citizen. You can see him wheezing. And he's not even doing his own stunts, and he's wheezing. It's, no. This movie, I give this movie a D. This movie is terrible. Do not see this movie. It's awful. Just freaking awful.
Harrison Ford's 2 years older than me, and I can tell you that if I have to run to avoid a car coming down the street, I'm toast.
Well, the thing is, I don't, Harrison Ford, I think, has had a much more
active life than I
don't know, because he looks 10 years older than you.
Uh-huh.
And frankly, when he runs, it's, he runs like a hobbled up little old man. It's,
hey, I'm
it's
older
not
than
good.
Keith Richards, too, so I'm there. I rest my case. Okay, that was Firewall, or Freefall.
Freefall.
Subtitle Freefall. Okay, I want to talk about a movie called Cachet. It's French. It means hidden. That's what the word means. My French is execrable, as everybody knows. Directed by a man named Michael Haneke. It stars Daniel Auteuil. You don't know the name, you'll know his face when you see it. And Juliette Binoche. This is a thriller, and this is unlike almost every thriller that you ever see, where everything is neatly resolved at the end. No matter how they manipulate your emotions while the thing is going on, this movie, when you walk out of the theater, you say, "Oh, God, I wonder what's going on." It refuses to It refuses to cater to everybody's desire to have a nice, everything wrapped up in a neat package. It's a Otuya and Binoche play a couple with a young boy, he's, maybe 13, 14 years old. And the first thing you see in the film is a very static shot of their house in, I think, Paris. I'm not sure. And, you know, you see traffic going by, and it's a long, medium a distance shot. There's a lot of those medium distance shot in this thing, and it tends to convey two things. One, you don't know what you're really watching, and two, there's a sense of distance that it gives you from the action, a kind of a voyeuristic thing. Well, it turns out that you're not actually seeing the front of their house. You're seeing a videotape of the front of their house, which they have been delivered, and they're trying to figure out what the hell is going on. Why would anybody videotape the front of our house and then leave the video for us? And therein the tale ensues. The mother, of course, is she's worried that something's going to happen. There's a sense of foreboding. But he gets angry. He wants to know who is doing this to him. You know, it's the male response versus the female response, I guess. So he starts trying to figure out what the heck's going on, you know. And I would have to say that I would have not have gone about it the same way he did. He does go to the police, and the police say, we cannot respond to something which is not even a threat. Police have to respond to an action, and there has been no action other than the fact that somebody videotaped the front of your house. This, of course, is what police do. This is accurate. As it turns out, there is a secret from his childhood, which, while bad, is not really bad. I mean, it was a nasty thing for the kid to do, but he was 6 years old. But this may be the crux of what's causing some person to observe their lives. Well, they get more and more... They get more and more of these tapes, more and more intimately. He finally realizes that one of the tapes shows his childhood home and then shows an apartment block somewhere. And he goes to the apartment block and he runs into somebody he knew from his childhood. I'm not going to give away too much more than that. But everything in this film creates more and more tension, more and more unease, more and more anxiety. This is a very, very gripping film. We've been through a whole spate of no thrills thrillers. This movie really gets you. At the end of the film, I was watching it in a commercial theater. The woman next to me, I've never seen before in my entire life, starts talking to me about the movie. What happened in that last scene? What happened The whole thing, reality, unreality, are you watching a videotape, are you watching a real thing, pervades the whole film. It totally discommodes you. I've been using the term Kafkaesque a lot. This movie is a visual representation of what Kafka did, giving you a vague sense of nameless terror, and you don't know what it's all about. And at the end, we think we know what happened, but we don't really know what happened. And the last scene is so ambiguous that it'll drive you nuts. I give this movie an A. This is the most amazing, creative, well-acted thriller. There was one niggling plot point that burned me, but I would have to say that I'm going to give it a pass because the totality of the film is so amazing. The film is called Cachet. I say go see it. It's a great movie. Two movies from the film festival. I haven't been able to get to the film festival thing because of the book. I'm going to start going. I've seen Cowboy Del Amor, which is a documentary. It's about a man named Ivan Thompson, the Cowboy Cupid. He fixes up American men, North American men, with Mexican women. Mexican women looking to move up in the world, perhaps come to the United States.
The Cowboy Cupid. I love that.
The Cowboy Cupid. He puts signs up all over the desert, you know, on the interstates with the... And he fixes them up with North American men, United States men, who are tired of the women that they know. They're all too tough, too cynical, too demanding, too divorced.
Uppity.
Exactly right. That's what it turns out to be. So I guess there's like three cases that we follow that Ivan Thompson, what he does is he takes the man down to Mexico, puts an ad in the paper, they sit in a cheap hotel room, and they wait for the phone to ring, and the phone starts ringing. Un hombre americano, you know, blah, 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 wants a Mexican wife who's, in one case, she had to be slender. And one case, you know, there's always some kind of thing like that.
But not unlike the fellas that look for the Russian mail order.
Exactly
brides,
right.
That
it's
they're
very
going to find
much like that.
Less
very
demanding
like that.
And, yeah.
Well, the thing is, as we go along, more of Ivan Thompson's life is revealed. He had a Mexican wife. He had a couple of American wives before that. He had a Mexican wife who he divorced and then remarried and then divorced again. He is so, his relationship to women is so ambiguous. He has no idea what he really feels about women, except that maybe they're too much for him. and he just wants somebody who won't open her mouth and will leave him alone and will make dinner and not say anything. But he's not that overt about it because I don't think he really intellectualizes it that way.
I bet he listens to Tom Likas.
He's a really nice man who has a real problem and doesn't understand it. That's Cowboy de la Mar. I gave it a B+. It's pretty good. The other movie is a movie called The Proposition, directed by John Hillcoat. It's got a great cast. Guy Pearce, Ray Winstone, Emily Watson. It's an Australian film. Sam Peckinpah Western in Australia in the 1880s. Guy Pearce is one of a gang of three brothers who are brutal murderers and thieves and rapists. Two of them get captured. The authorities send Guy Pearce out to capture the third one, and then they won't hang him and his kid brother. I can't tell you too much more about it, but this movie is like Peckinpah, issues of family, issues of loyalty and honor, the whole thing bathed in blood. If this is an ultra-violent film, if you have a problem with that, don't go. The movie itself is gritty and cynical. I really enjoyed the film. Movie violence doesn't really bother me that much, I have to admit it. This movie, like I say, is not for everyone, but it's a tough, well-acted movie. Another interesting sidelight, Nick Cave, the rocker, wrote the music and the screenplay for this.
Yeah,
so apparently he's looking to stretch out a little bit. And while the screenplay is occasionally self-indulgent and clearly copped from Sam Peckinpah, it's not bad for a first effort, I would have to say. So again, give this movie a B+ also. The title of the movie is The Proposition. Cowboy de la Mar, both films from the Portland International Film Festival. The Northwest Film Center phone number is 221-1156, or you can go to nwfilm.org.
You had such a better week than I did.
I did, didn't I? Cachet started it off. So I even went to a Eagle Theater, which I really hate to see this, and I was blown away by it. Okay, let's go over the films that we did. Mrs. Henderson?
Not bad. B-E. Not a cute little movie.
Okay. Emmett Till, must be seen. It must be seen especially by young people who think that, what's the race problem in this country all about? Final Destination, Trois.
Not bad. If you like the first two, you'll like this one just fine.
Firewall?
Stay away. Stay far, far away.
Okay. So build a firewall between yourself and the phone. Cachet, I say go see it. It's the most disturbing original thriller I've seen in a long, long time. And the two International Film Festival films, Cowboy de la Mar and The Proposition, I recommend them, although the Cowboy de la Mar is a much gentler film, at least physically. There's no violent abuse in it. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thank you very much, my friend Don Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Goldberg.
And thank you all out there.
College would like to invite you to the 16th Annual African Film Festival honoring Black History Month at PCC's Cascade Campus. This year's festival will feature 28 political, historical, and socially charged films as seen through the eyes of Africans. The films will cover a wide range of themes and topics, from the African legacy in Mexico, women's ongoing struggle for equality and independence, to love across class lines and preservation of African cultural and artistic heritage. This KBOO co-sponsored festival will be free of charge and will cover a 5-week period from February 3rd through March 4th. For more information, go to www.africanfilmfestival.org or call 503 844-6111, extension 3630.
And this is the Wednesday morning radio zine on KABU, your community radio. And coming up, Per Fagerin will be talking about empire and its limits. Stay tuned at 10 for People Rise Up with Andrew Geller when he's speaking with Lauren Regan from the Eugene-based Civil Liberties Defense Center. And then activist, author, and ethnic studies professor Ward Churchill will join the show. And at 11, it's Democracy Now!